Welcome to the Swallow Your Pride podcast. I'm your host, Teresa Richard. I'm a board-certified specialist in swallowing and swallowing disorders, and I know firsthand how much confusing and conflicting information there is out there about how we assess and treat swallowing disorders. This podcast is all about bringing everyone together, getting on the same page, being open to new ideas, and using evidence-based treatment strategies for our patients with dysphagia. So let's get into it. Just a quick disclaimer that all statements and opinions expressed in this episode do not reflect on the organizations associated with the speakers and are their own opinions solely. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. It's been a while since I've blabbed to you for a little while. Some people love it. Some people hate it. Sorry about that. Either way. Yeah, happy almost spring. Well, it's technically spring, but I think it's almost May here. I am heading to the New York State Convention to do a talk there this weekend. I'm excited. That's always my favorite because it's my home state. But I love this conversation today. I think you guys are going to love it with Emily, too. She's also a fellow New Yorker. Just a conversation that we need to be having about how we treat our end-of-life dementia patients. And one thing Emily mentions in the episode is that she joined my Inner Circle Leadership Academy group. And it's just been such a career change, game changer for her. And while I'm not accepting any applications currently, I will be in the next month or two. So if you want to get your application in now, you can. I probably won't go through them for another month or two, but if listening to Emily gets you juiced up and you want to consider joining, you can go to bit.ly/R Inner Circle. That's bit.ly/TR Inner Circle, and the T and the R are capitalized. So if you do want to apply, like I said, I'll probably be opening that within the next month or two once things slow down. They've been a little chaotic around here. But like I said, this is a great conversation with Emily. I just love everything she has to say. And I also want to thank a new sponsor that we have, which this sponsor is completely appropriate for this episode. And I'm so glad that they've partnered with this episode. But I want to thank Provail, the Provail Cup, for sponsoring this episode. Would you like to ensure that your patients are really taking small sips? Do you want to support oral hydration without increasing the burden on staff and give our cognitively impaired patients a realistic option for continuing thin liquids? The Provail Cup delivers a fixed amount of either 5 cc or 10 cc's of thin liquid and requires a normal drinking motion, facilitating self-pacing. The Provail Cup is dishwasher safe and has been supporting independent hydration for many years. To learn more, visit ReliantMP.com or check out Provail Cup on YouTube or email sales@ReliantMP.com to assist in getting the Provail Cup in your facility. So again, thank you to Provail for sponsoring this episode, and I hope you guys enjoy it. All right, and one more thing, and in honor of, what is this, May, which is Better Speech and Hearing and Swallowing Month, we can add in, MedBridge has agreed to do their awesome promo deal for listeners of Swallow Your Pride. So if you go to medbridgeeducation.com and click on their premium plan and enter promo code SYP at checkout, you can get a year's worth of their premium plan for only $95. So why is this such a killer deal? Because it's usually $425. And I think they have some incredible, awesome courses. So really high quality courses for ASHA CEUs. I believe they have over 500 of them now. They're just growing, expanding rapidly of all topics. And I just checked this morning, some of the more recent topics they're including now is PDPM, which I know we're all freaking out about come this fall with how that's going to impact our profession. Also, if you're a home health SLP, they have tons of series on OASIS too, which I know can be really tricky because it's nothing you learn about until you're thrown into home health. And let's see, they have a lot of new aphasia courses on spaced retrieval, the life participation approach, lots of dementia material. Their voice courses are awesome. I know they're incredibly reputable and high quality. Counseling, which we don't get much of in grad school. Head and neck cancer, motor speech. I know Dr. Michelle Trochet, I'm super impressed with her motor speech series that she has on here. And also about cough dysfunction, which I think is so important that a lot of us don't learn too much about. Also courses on trachs and motivational interviewing. So just some really cool courses on there. So they're at medbridgeeducation.com. You can go to /SYP, or you can just go to the premium plan and add the promo code, enter SYP, and you'll get that premium plan for only $95. Now, what's the difference between the premium plan and the education plan, which is normally $95, is with the premium plan, you also get access to their home exercise builder, which is awesome. You can go in, you can click exercises for your patients to do. Your patients can get a login to log in from home and see descriptions of all the exercises that you give them. They have some really good patient handouts. They also have a mobile app. So you get all these extra features in addition to over 500 courses that are all registered for ASHA CEUs. So if you're interested, go to medbridgeeducation.com/SYP or enter SYP for the promo code for the premium plan. And you can access this premium plan for one full year for $95. So when you do use promo code SYP, just know that I do get a small commission that goes right back into keeping this wonderful podcast going. So this special will be going through till the end of the month. So take advantage of it if you can. This is episode 87 of the Swallow Your Pride podcast, and today we are back again with Emily Tricarico. So I hope you enjoy part two of this awesome episode.
So something I actually recently read and I wanted to discuss was a recent New York Times article that's been floating around social media recently.
Yes.
And that big doctor in service I did was actually on feeding tubes, nutritional considerations in the advanced dementia population. As we know from literature, research, and previous podcasts, feeding tubes are not shown via the evidence to prolong life or have kind of really any positive impact on patients with advanced dementia. So that's something I did my in-service in, and it went really, really well.
Yeah.
I'm very proud of everyone who participated in my in-service at how well they received this information. So now there's this New York Times article floating around. It's actually from 2016, but it's recently just become more popular on social media. So the article was written by Paula Spann, and it's called The Decline of Tube Feeding in Dementia Patients. So it describes a patient with advanced dementia, likely stage 6 or 7 on the global deterioration scale. And this woman, she was in a nursing home, and doctors recommended a feeding tube for weight gain because she was losing weight, right? The family said no, which I find that often families aren't empowered with enough education to say no. So I think this is a really good example of how it can be done.
Yeah.
So the patient and the family had discussions years before, and they consider that quality of life is the most important consideration. This woman, she was a nurse and she had family in the medical field. So this is something that she was actually educated on. In the article, they stated that 12% of dementia patients in SNFs in 2000 had a feeding tube. And that actually by 2014, this decreased to less than 6%. The author stated that change comes slowly, but it does come. So this is definitely trending in the right direction.
Oh, good.
Based on the evidence. It's getting there. I think in my area, I wouldn't be surprised if these numbers were higher.
Yeah, I think in mine too. Yeah.
It seems like a lot more than 6%.
Yeah.
In SNFs with dementia. Now, this might be considering patients in all stages of dementia. So, you know, your stages 1 through 5 aren't going to have feeding tubes because their feeding and swallowing skills have not been impacted yet. So that might be taking into consideration that number, but I find it to be a lot higher.
Yeah.
In the article, it discussed Dr. Mitchell and her research. She's been researching the effect of feeding tubes in the dementia population for over 20 years. And she states that the message is clear and that there are more risks than benefits. And based on everything I've read, there's actually maybe no benefits to tube feeding in the advanced dementia population. The American Geriatric Society, the Alzheimer's Association, and Choosing Widely all agree, and they have created position statements. I'll go into in a couple of minutes. I know some people have discussed it on some other podcasts. And if you want more information, you should definitely look at these position statements. So now families and physicians seem to have gotten the sorrowful message. Dementia is a terminal disease. Eating and swallowing problems eventually plague almost everyone who has it. Feeding tubes don't help. In fact, they can make matters worse, says the author. She's right.
Yeah.
The article also says that African-American patients are 5 times more likely to receive alternate nutrition hydration than NIH, and that for-profit nursing homes are more likely to use feeding tubes than not-for-profit nursing homes. I believe the article also said that larger nursing homes had a higher use of feeding tubes than smaller ones.
Interesting.
So it's definitely an interesting article if you want to know more about this.
Yeah.
And it's great to show families, I think, because families don't have great education and not always going to ask them to read these lengthy research articles.
Yeah.
So you might want to direct them towards that New York Times article.
Yeah. So why, let me ask you, Emily, why do you think that doctors are still going this direction? Like, why do you think some are still telling families like that's the way to go with your 95-year-old grandfather with advanced dementia?
So I actually think there's a lot of reasons. One is specialists kind of blindness to everything going on except for what they're treating. It also helps. They think, some of the doctors told me that they thought it helped get patients out of the hospital faster, which we've actually found to not be true. They actually stay longer. I think it's something like double or three times the length of stay for those patients. Sometimes I think it's easier. And then the biggest takeaway I had from my in-service with the doctor is they had no idea that hand feeding was something.
Yeah.
They didn't know that patients with dementia benefit from hand feeding, careful hand feeding by loved ones and people they're familiar with preferred foods. They thought if someone, you know, if they're not accepting it from a nurse, they're not going to take it from everyone or anyone. And I think a lot of it is just they're not well versed in the fact that it doesn't prolong life.
Yeah.
So back in 1981, PEG was created. The PEG was created to help patients who can't meet their nutritional needs by mouth. And then for years, it was adapted very quickly to your dementia patients. And then since then, the research has been showing that it's not doing what we've set out to do. And I think there's just so much to learn in the medical field that people aren't able to absorb everything. And sometimes this is the last thing on their list of things to look into.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a few thoughts here. Number one, I remember last time we talked about this, I got like a bunch of emails. People were jumping down my throats that like PEGs were important for like head and neck cancer population, things like that. Yes, absolutely. That's not what we're saying here. We're specifically talking about the dementia population. So just check that fact real quick. And then the other thing, can you elaborate a little bit more on hand feeding? Because I know that for some people, that's still like such a foreign concept, like such a really kind of a new concept to a lot of people in our field. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. I can. Back to what you just said, though, that is something that I had as a big takeaway from one-to-one education when I first started the whole maybe we shouldn't just put PEGs in everybody with dementia fight. People took that to mean that I meant feeding tubes are no good. They also took that to mean the very, very harsh, just let them die.
Yeah,
which is something I would never ever say. So I realized that one-to-one quick education in the hallway, they were only hearing part of my message. And the part they were hearing was not positive. So yes, right now we're only talking about the advanced dementia population. There is definitely a place for feeding tubes in, you know, kiddos who, you know, were born preterm or have medical issues, for people with, you know, acute strokes who need time to recover, for your head and neck cancer patients. So it's really only for your advanced dementia population.
Yeah.
That being said, so hand feeding is actually where you take food that the patient likes, that is culturally appropriate for them, their preferred foods, and in not using utensils or, you know, sometimes in the hospital we use tongue depressors. We're actually using our hands to bring the food to that patient's mouth. They are much more likely to accept it because they're still a lot of the time recognizing our body parts, as opposed to apraxia where they're not recognizing utensils anymore as something used for feeding. So that, you know, their cognition loss is interfering with their ability to recognize utensils. So you're giving them their preferred foods. You're bringing it to their mouth with their hands. You're letting them open their mouth and accept it. So it's less intrusive. They're getting the food right there so they can smell it and they can see it. With my patients, I actually take, even if they're not able to move their hands or grab anything, I take their hands and I put it on the food so that they can start to make the connections that this is something they like.
Yeah.
Also, something to keep in mind that your patients with advanced dementia, a lot of time they're bed bound, so they're not burning the amount of calories you and I are. They don't need the same calories. Also, their GI system is starting to shut down as part of their disease process. So even if we're pumping all this nutrition in, even if we're feeding them full meals, their body isn't absorbing those calories properly.
Yeah, that's such a good point too. I think there's so much that we don't know about like malnutrition, and you know, I know of a close family friend that's been dealing with that too. And it's like, we just try to feed him so much, but his body just doesn't seem to be absorbing it. And it's like, yes, mm-hmm. He's, you know, end stage dementia. That's kind of what happens at that point. So
Mm-hmm. And a lot of doctors say, well, we have to prevent bed sores, and pegs and G-tubes are actually shown to increase bed sores, that artificial nutrition hydration. It's increasing all of that. It's increasing fluid retention. It's increasing your reflux, your risk of getting aspiration pneumonia. So sometimes it's actually cutting life shorter when all we're trying to do is prolong life. It's actually cutting it shorter. You know, with this, palliative care really needs to be involved. That's really my first recommendation always if someone has advanced dementia, or even if someone just has, you know, early on dementia, I want palliative care to be consulted to start the education process and to help me educate. So it's not just the SLP's word against the doctor who might not be as well versed in this topic as we are.
Yeah. Can you go back and kind of explain a little bit more about what you just said with, like, because I know people will be like, what do you mean PEG tubes don't prevent aspiration, they can cause more bed sores. Can you kind of go into a little more specifics on those?
Yeah, absolutely. So we know as SLPs the importance of raising the head of bed and having people sit up when they eat or drink. When someone's on a feeding tube, often they have poor mobility status. So they are totally dependent on other people to be raising their head of bed and making sure that they stay that way. So reflux is actually shown to increase with tube feeding. And if someone's not in the right position, then they're going to reflux and they're probably going to aspirate their tube fed material. Yeah. So that's really a horrible effect of tube feeding. Also, if someone is not eating and drinking by mouth and is relying on a feeding tube, they are not going to be swallowing as often. So you're cutting out, you know, three meals a day and water throughout the day. You're getting rid of those swallows. So then you're only swallowing your saliva. And typically these people already have impaired swallow. So then they're getting disuse atrophy from not eating and not swallowing because of eating and drinking. Then their swallow is going to become further impaired. Then they're going to continue to aspirate their saliva probably as their swallow becomes more impaired. Then they're also not clearing the oral bacteria out of their mouth. And then you're increasing your risk of aspiration of saliva and of the tube fed material. And so that's just a really, really deadly combination.
Yeah. I love that you just said all that, because I, like, so many times I'll get these calls from SLPs. Like, just last week I had one and she said, you know, we can't figure out why this guy keeps getting aspiration pneumonia. He's been on a tube for 3 years. Like, he's had recurrent pneumonia. And I go in and of course he's like laying completely flat.
Course.
And I was like, no, like, he needs to be upright. And, you know, I started to explain all this stuff and, like, the nurses were just totally, like, mind blown, you know, and I, so thank you for explaining all of that.
Yeah. I mean, I stay at my hospital and my nurses are very well versed in, you know, the bed needs to be a certain way, but family members come in and lay that patient down.
Yeah.
The patient soils themselves and they have to be changed. And, you know, the tube feeding is ongoing and they stop it. But what I tell patients I work with that have feeding tubes is they need to remain sitting upright for 45 minutes afterwards. We need to make sure that, you know, the stomach is starting to clear out before they're laid flat. And that's also something I tell families when they're considering getting a feeding tube for their loved one with dementia, because we can educate. So we're blue in the face, but for some people, they can't conceptualize the fact that we're not doing everything we can to help them. And so it's a patient's family's right if they want to put in a feeding tube. Right. I will never disregard what a patient family wants, but I will educate them. And I'll say, this is something to be considered, that if they're on continuous feeds, they can't lay flat. If they're on bolus feeds, they can't lay flat for 45 minutes afterwards. And what I tell doctors is we can't prevent aspiration of saliva. There's short of a laryngectomy, there is nothing we can do to prevent that. So we can put a feeding tube in everyone who aspirates, but they're still going to get sick.
Right.
And so, you know, the Alzheimer's Association's position statement even says it's ethically permissible to withhold nutrition and hydration artificially administered when the individual with dementia is in the end stages. You know, all of this research and all of these, you know, organizations that are at the top of the dementia fields are all saying, you know, what we're saying, and it's just change. Like the article, the New York Times article said, change is slow, but it comes. And I think it's the responsibility of the SLP to educate, you know, the families and the medical professionals on the team about this, because, again, you can't know everything.
Right.
And you don't know what you didn't know until you know that you didn't know it.
Yep, totally.
Yeah. And so a lot of times it just takes a little bit of education before people realize, oh, I was doing it wrong the whole time, but let me change it now.
Right. Absolutely. I think, you know, and I think what I love most about doing this podcast is that, like, we just keep learning and we keep learning and we keep learning. And it's like, we learned about reflux, we learned about oral care, we learned about PEG tubes. And it's like, I feel like we're finally getting to a point that we're all, like, critically thinking about these things, about how it's kind of like the perfect storm of a lot of these isolated incidences that cause these things. You know, we can't pinpoint one single thing. You know, I mean, you look at, you know, Susan Langmore's predictors of pneumonia, like, you cannot pinpoint one specific thing. There's, yeah, a lot of things that contribute.
And I think we also know a lot about all of these individual topics, but we don't necessarily put them together.
Right.
So we see someone with bad oral care, we're like, okay, let's fix that, but and then they'll be fine. But then we're not thinking about the feeding tubes and our aspiration precautions. So I think a lot of the times you have to take all of this information and combine it together. And then everything that we're talking about makes sense.
Yep.
But it needs to be presented to people as a cohesive, you know, chunk of information, and then it all makes sense.
Yep, absolutely.
I mean, also another thing to consider with your advanced dementia and feeding tubes is that feeding tubes lead to increased use of restraints, chemical or physical.
Oh, okay.
And I think that's something to consider as well, because some of these people, you know, when you're in stage 7 of advanced dementia, they're saying that you have about 6 months left to live. We want these people's last 6 months to be strapped to a bed or sedated. I think that's really something that needs to be considered. And patients' families really need to be hearing about that.
Yeah.
When they're considering a feeding tube, it shouldn't just be, well, we can put in this. It might not help, but maybe it will. We need to think, are they going to need to be chemically restrained? Are they going to have infections from the feeding tube? You know, putting in a feeding tube is a surgery. That's something to be considered. And 70% of feeding tubes put in annually results in complications.
Yeah.
That's a huge number.
Yeah.
So I think that's something that they really, you know, we need to tell families about when they're making this decision. We also need to tell them that it's possible that the material that they're using for the tube feeding, I forget what it's called.
Like the formula almost.
The formula, yeah. Thank you. That's not always covered.
Yeah.
And so I evaluated a patient recently who had advanced dementia. She was taking food and liquid by mouth, but not a lot. The family decided to go with a feeding tube anyway, but because in my notes, it said that she could swallow, the insurance wouldn't pay for it. And so now the family was left with the responsibility of paying for the formula and the artificial nutrition hydration.
Oh, goodness.
And yeah. Because my note said that they could eat.
Yeah.
And I absolutely won't write my note that this patient can't eat, because, I mean, that'd be lying.
Right.
Fraud. I'm not doing that. And so now this family was stuck, and no one ever educated them that it might not be covered.
Right.
And it's expensive.
Right.
So that's another thing that we need to think about when we're educating families. They need to be told all the information.
Yeah. I definitely didn't consider that either.
Yeah. If you want to talk about, like, your game changer, life changing resources,
yeah,
we can talk about that. Well, one is Predictors of Aspiration.
Yeah.
Pneumonia by Susan Langmore. That's everyone. My second one is Tide. I really learned a lot from your American Geriatric Society position statement on feeding tubes and advanced dementia, and the Alzheimer's Association position statement. These are really, really easy reads for, you know, even the non-clinician. So I think that's something, if this is a topic interesting to everyone, they should really check out. And then the third is actually something not on this topic, because I work in the peds world, and I know a lot of your listeners really want more peds information, would be the book Raising a Happy and Healthy Eater by Melanie Pottick and Dr. Fernando. That's a really great resource if you work in the world of peds and feeding. So that was a game changer for me early on in my career.
Yeah, awesome. Thanks, Emily. I think, like, what's so important is those position statements, you know, and another reason why I love this podcast so much is, like, people think they're, like, you know, barking up the wrong tree, or they just can't produce that, like, one article that's going to get the doctor to get it. You know, and I think these are so important, like a position statement from the Alzheimer's Association, a position statement from the American Geriatric Society. Like, these are really surefire articles that can really help to swing the needle in the direction you want it to go. So,
mm-hmm. And it really says everything in such certain terms, like, this is not a treatment we should be considering for these people. This is not evidence-based. these are all of the risks. There are no benefits. I mean, they're very, very strong in their statements. Yeah. It's not some wishy-washy, well, maybe there's one patient that helps. They are saying the research shows that it is not appropriate. And I know on this podcast, you're all about, you know, showing the evidence and using evidence-based practice. And that's something I discussed with the doctors. This is not an evidence-based practice.
Yeah.
This is something that we're doing out of habit, but it's not doing what we're setting out to do. And are we actually harming people? So it's definitely something that needs to be considered more carefully.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's like what's so interesting too is do the palliative care doctors do a lot of that education?
They do. So I always called for them, but I didn't really work with them until, you know, probably the last 6 months. And then recently we had a patient who advanced dementia, all kinds of comorbidities. I was educating them, but they were still considering a feeding tube because the doctor was pushing it. So I brought palliative care on and I happened to be there during their initial consult and I stopped and listened. And the palliative care doctor said everything that I say, almost word for word. I mean, she was so strong in her education. I was, you know, so impressed. And she said it with, you know, great authority. And afterwards I took her aside and she said, I know it's very frustrating that I the rest of the field hasn't caught up with what you and I are educating them on.
Yeah.
And I know the other palliative care doctors feel the same way. So they are fighting for education. I actually think they're the best educators in the hospital on this because they combine what SLPs know and what physicians know. And they really look at the big picture. And I think even if the family is not accepting palliative care, there should be a consult.
Yeah.
I'm actually working with my hospital that anybody with that is, they're considering a feeding tube for, there's an automatic consult for palliative care.
Yes, I love
that. So that doesn't mean that they're going to be on palliative care going forward. It just means that that doctor is going to come and speak to that family and do education and assess if the patient is appropriate. So it really opens up the lines of communication.
Yeah, because I think so many things of what you just said are so important. Like, had the family known that, you know, they couldn't be laid flat or they'd have to sit up for 45 minutes or they'd have to pay for the formula. You know, I think there's so many things that, you know, we consider, but it's like, if you say that to a family, that's automatically going to change their mind.
Yeah.
So,
And I think it's helpful to even just, you know, as I think it was Dan Weinstein on episode 6 said, you know, tell the family just to go and Google it.
Like,
Google pay and dementia, and everything will come up saying it's not appropriate.
Yeah.
And look, sometimes you're not going to be able to educate families appropriately and I don't want to say change their minds, but they're not going to be on your side with this. And that's fine. That's, again, they're right. Just like, it's a right of a patient to say, I want a cheeseburger when I'm on puree. Absolutely. They're right. But it's our responsibility to be educating them and let them know that this isn't an evidence-based, you know, treatment strategy. And these are the risks. These are our options.
Yeah.
Now it's up to you as a family to make the decision. And I think that the education aspect of that is so important.
Yeah. I think like those are the most like soul crushing words to me. Like when a family says like, I wish I had known, you know, like as soon as a family like starts to say that to me, I'm like, oh my God, you know, like I wish someone had educated them about this stuff first. You know, I mean, there's just so many times I go in and same thing. Like I deal with patients that are on like honey thick liquids that are now, they're not drinking anything. They're having recurrent UTIs, you know, and it's like, we should have discussed these things before we put this patient on honey thick liquids a year ago, you know? Mm-hmm.
A change I would actually like to see with regards to this is I think when patients are getting their initial diagnosis of dementia, this is something that the doctor should be telling them.
Yeah.
Eventually you will most likely get to a point where you're in the advanced dementia stage, the end stage of dementia, and you won't be eating and drinking anymore.
Yeah, well, that's so true. I mean, that's like what they're doing with like ALS patients and stuff now is, you know, they're like preparing them for how it may be, you know, a year from now. Yeah, that's such a good point.
I think most of the patients I see, their families tell me, no one's ever told me they were going to have difficulty swallowing.
Yeah.
No one's ever told me this. And I think my mind's blown. I say, I'm sorry. As a medical professional, I'm sorry that we weren't educating you properly.
Yeah.
Like now I'm going to do my best to educate you, but it's a lot, especially in acute care. I mean, you're hitting them with a lot of bad information when they're already there and it's a sad moment for them.
Yeah.
So I really would like to see, you know, the medical world better educating patients who have a terminal illness because dementia is a terminal illness. They should be better prepared of all of the things that are going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's such a good point.
So that the patient can partake in the decision-making process before they get to the point where they can't and the family has to make all the decisions.
Yeah.
Because I know, if it was me and I had dementia, I wouldn't want to put that responsibility on my family.
Yeah.
I would want to make that decision for myself so that no one else had to. And that's the way I would want it. Yeah. So.
I think, it kind of reminds me of a situation I had a few days ago. I had this man that I think he was like 96 or something, but still in like really good health. Like I would have had no idea he was that old, but his swallow was pretty bad, more of like an esophageal dysphagia. It was every single thing was just being regurgitated from the UES, just everything. And so, we didn't take a rocket science to figure out, something's going on here. So I just said, I'm going to recommend that you go to a GI doctor. And he was like, nope. And I was like, okay. And I was like, do you want me to explain why? And he's like, no. And he's like, I signed this paper and I met with my wife and I met with all of our kids and I decided that I don't want to go see any more doctors for the rest of my life. I really like it here and I just want to live here and I'm 96 and I'm going to die somehow. So that's it. And I was like, dude, I respect that. Like,
yeah.
But I thought, I was like, well, good for you for like having those conversations. Like, and I was like, do you want me to even write that recommendation in the report? I was like, where should I go from here? And he's like, nope, I don't want you to even write it. Like, just write what you see. I was like, okay. So I had to go have a conversation with the nurse and the doctor after, because I was like, this is what I saw, but these were his wishes. And the doctor was like, yep, we know. So, all right, cool. Thanks. Like,
yeah, so. That's great. I mean, I think that's great. Him being so strong and advocating for what he wants. After my presentation with the doctors on this information, one doctor pulled me aside and he said, this is actually a decision I made. He's like 10 years ago. It's in my will that I don't want any feeding tubes. I if I'm going, just let me go.
Yeah.
He's like, I don't want that for myself. So then, it's not him who often recommends feeding tubes, but I think, medical professionals, we all say, I don't ever want a feeding tube.
Right.
Like, unless I have, I'm young and I have an acute stroke and I'm on the road to recovery, I don't want a feeding tube ever, and then we turn to our patients and say, well, I'm going to recommend a feeding tube.
Right,
think we have to think, if it's not something we would want, is it something we should be recommending?
Right.
I mean, obviously we should educate the patient, the family on all the options, but think about what you would want.
Right. I have a patient that he did not want a feeding tube and I'm still not sure how it happened, but he got one and he's gotten MRSA in the site, I think like 5 times now.
Oh my God.
And the doctor at the facility is just like, I'm just not sure like what to do at this point. And I'm like, well, he actually can swallow. He doesn't need this feeding tube. But it's one of those cases of like, you don't realize all the side effects that can happen. Like this poor man that was pretty healthy before this happened ended up having a downward spiral of a, feeding tube and then 5 cases of MRSA. And then he ended up going septic. And like, it's just been this whole downward spiral of things that probably could have been prohibited. So
I know we think it's just going to be this easy fix. And oftentimes we're all afraid, we're all afraid of this big, bad aspiration. And oftentimes the treatments are worse than the actual disease in the first place.
Yeah.
So again, I mean, that's just something that needs to be considered. We have to consider quality of life, especially in dementia.
Yeah. Oh, that's the other thing I wanted to, cause you had mentioned something about like surgery complications.
Mm-hmm.
Did you say there was a percentage of patients that's...
So 70%, I think it was 2006, 70% of the tubes placed resulted in complications.
That is absolutely insane.
Now those complications aren't necessarily surgical complications, like the actual surgery, but it's infection at the site, dislodging of the tube, things of that nature as well. So 70%, I mean, even if it's, you fix right away, 70% is, that's high.
That's very high.
That's really high. And it's, people don't think, oh, it's easy, we'll just put in a peg. Like, I've seen a peg put in a bedside. And I, early on in my career, I used to say, oh, it's easy, they do it at bedside. It takes 3 minutes. And then I learned about all the complications. And now I'm not so quick to recommend them, at all.
Yeah.
But I think it was in 2006. I'll find that information. It'll be in my resources for the show.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, because I know there's like some that say that it's actually can be like a dangerous surgery. And I didn't know if have you.
Yeah, I think it depends whether it's a peg or a G-tube.
Gotcha.
But obviously, there's anesthesia, whether it's like complete, like you're getting put under, or it's just a sedative, there are complications. I was in 2007, and you can find that in the enteral nutrition policy in 2010. So it says, in 2007, 70% of the 188,000 pegs placed in the United States resulted in complications. Also, in that statement, it said that the length of hospitalization doubles when a patient has a PICC placed. So the average length of stay would be 11.7 days compared to 4.6 days.
Yeah, crazy.
And, you know, when I talk to these doctors and you know, their whole thing is we'd like to put a feeding tube in so we can get them out to the next level of care. We don't want to keep them in the hospital. It's actually shown that because they have that prolonged length of stay because then they're waiting for medical clearance for the procedure. They're waiting for the MD scheduled care. They're waiting for the family decision. They're waiting for the tube feeding to start after the feeding tube is put in. Then they're waiting for patient tolerance. Then you have all kinds of like tummy issues afterwards.
Yeah.
You get your constipation, your diarrhea, those sort of things. And again, those aren't necessarily explained to families when they're going in, when they're, you know, giving their approval for this procedure.
Yeah. 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 That's another thing. I remember a guy I had was ended up being like allergic to the formula.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's insane.
Yeah. It happens. I know some people just flenderize like what the patient normally eats and put it in the feeding tube. I don't know if that is more dangerous. If it's less dangerous, that would be more of a registered dietitian's and GI, you know, question. But again, these just aren't things that are considered or the families aren't educated on.
Yeah.
It's always a simple procedure. We'll, you know, we'll see how they feel. They might have some discomfort, but there just really needs to be, like I said, it needs to be more education and families need to be told that there are other options besides a feeding tube.
Yeah, definitely. All right. Well, thanks so much, Emily.
You're welcome. Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. Do you have anything else to add?
I don't think so.
All right.
All I can say is if you do have another inner circle leadership, everyone should join.
Oh, why? Thank you.
Everyone should apply. It is the best thing I've ever done in my career.
Oh, thanks, Emily.
For my career.
I super appreciate that. So, all right. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You too.
So if you would love to hear more of these episodes and get some easily digestible bites of swallowing knowledge, then please leave a review on iTunes or pledge a small amount on patreon.com/swallowyourpride, because that is what keeps these episodes coming. Also, don't forget to subscribe, share with your closest colleagues, and show notes will always be available to download over on swallowyourpridepodcast.com, where you can also be notified of the latest podcast episodes. Also, credit to Stephanie Jacobson for her incredible editing skills, and thank you so much to all of you for listening.